I've decided to go on gallery view. I find it always a bit disconcerting to me see myself on this big image and then see these little post stamps on top. So I feel more comfortable to sit in the midst of all of us. But when we give instructions, and obviously you have the choice too, sometimes it's nice to have the teacher to focus on them. And obviously also in the movement practice, it can be helpful. And I find it often very reassuring to see the teacher. But now I'm on the other side, and I want to see you. I don't want to only see me. So I was wondering what I should talk about today. And first and overall, very, very lovely how we moved together over these days and we have one more day. And I thought I might go back to give us some pointers where the yoga practice sits within that spiritual journey we are engaging in. And the Patanjali Sutras is accepted as the core text if you want to go to understand the aspects of the yoga practice. And as I always said, I think I would possibly once opened that book, looked into it, and would have closed it again. The text is extremely condensed. I think for me, it was very helpful to be with my yoga teacher for 40 years, who, in a way, pointed us to our normal lives and then said, and that's why we speak about nonviolence. So he gave us pointers. And there's lots of commentaries written on these Patanjali sutras, but all would, I'm supposed to increase my volume. Wait a second. Yes, thank you for telling me. I hope that's better. So when we read the commentaries, they still point us to our own practice. So even when, and I think they are very helpful, you would still be asked to do your own practice so that the pointers given to you are verified in your practice or through the dialogues with your teacher. And the Patanjali Sutras, in their very condensed way, the first sutra and where things are placed in these books is important too. So the first sutra starts with the word atta, atta, and that means end now. Atta yoga anusasanam. Here, end now. We are telling you about the practice of the yoga. And the word end now points us to two important aspects. It's a bit like cutting through. It points us to the sense, and why am I starting it now? What did happen before that, before I came on this retreat? What made me come to this retreat? And at sometimes it could be a very beneficial habit. We've done it always. It might be based on your work. Some of you might have to do a retreat as part of the training. But often the first time around when we go on a retreat has that quality that we were shaken. Something got us to the point, and I've tried this and I've tried that, and I'm still, in some sense, I'm still experiencing some dissatisfaction. I'm at the point where I want to find a way where my life seems to be more full or more content. So we often start from a point of dissatisfaction in our lives. And one of the commentaries, and I think that's very interesting, he says you need to nearly have reached a point of no hope. You really, to be really actively engaged in your yoga practice or in a spiritual practice, you need to acknowledge all the things you did. And they all got you back to the point they worked somehow, and there is still some sense of something is lacking. I heard from a Christian friend, they speak about that they say there is inside, and I just felt the image helpful, that inside of us is a little hole, a little dark hole, and in it, in their language, God is sitting and waiting for you to reach down to get there. So that means that sense of dissatisfaction we might at times experience. And that can play out in different ways. We want things to stay the same and they change. Or we want things to change. We have a difficult team leader and they don't change and we have to accommodate or live with that or go for a change. So we live in a changing world where we possibly have come to realize wherever we put our safety on, it might be a little bit slippery. And it is from that point that we might at times experience anxieties and we look for some quality. What is there that I can trust? What is there in this changing world that gives me a safe ground, a safe place to be? So we would say that starting point is very important, that sense where we acknowledge whatever you've tried, it worked to some extent, but there is still that niggling feeling. And then it is for us to continue the journey, because often that little bit of crack has appeared and then we plaster over it, because it can be quite painful to accept that difficulty we are finding us in. There is in the Indian stories, there's a lovely story about a wood collector, and he goes into the wood and he's old and he's worn out, and as he collects the wood, he's just nearly finishing it, and then he stumbles and it all falls down. And he's so fed up in that moment. He really has enough. So he's in this point, now that's it. And he shouts and calls for the god of death. He says, "Death, come. I really have enough now. It's really enough." And death comes and says, "Oh, you called me." And at that moment, he says, "Oh, no. Death, please, can you just help me to collect all my wood sticks so that I can carry them home?" So these moments of difficulty, they are a chance so that we can step out of the things we've always done and he got us always into the same place. So we might want to really honor that feeling of dissatisfaction, of unease, that in itself can hold a gift. I would say for me, the word that might be helpful is the word that possibly we experience some form of disconnection. We feel disconnected from the ground of our being in the deepest essence. And we at times, if I see myself and others I work with, there is a disconnection from us. There is a disconnection from some very painful experiences that seem to be part of life. I think some of us had very traumatic childhoods. So there was the only way to handle that was nearly to go to places definitely of disconnecting from those painful experiences to the point of disassociation. And for some of us, that might have been so difficult that this person will always need a steady presence and support system around them. And for others, it might have been I think what in Germany long time ago an author spoke about the original wounding, the fact that we are born into a family will carry in it the potential that we will be wounded, because our parents were wounded in, to some extent. So it is in the nature of being born that to some extent we will have experienced woundedness. And it might be that our parents couldn't cope with some of the things and they rejected an aspect of us. And then we added in, because for us it was difficult with that, we then also abandoned that part in us that was wounded because it felt unloved. And that woundedness is felt physically. We might hold very deep tensions that have begun to wrap around a wound in us. So to some extent, we disconnected from us. And the invitation of any spiritual life is to stop that disconnection, to reconnect. And that is the reconnection with ourselves and through that process, a reconnection with the world around us. And then hopefully in that process, a deeper connection with the source of our being, with the ground of our being. So if you look at physical pain, and physical pain is often holding the emotional pain. So if we are acknowledging that in this pain could be a hidden diamond, it could be that in this pain is a calling for us to turn around, to stop running away, to stop keeping us busy, to stop turning away. And there were times when that was useful. And that still might be useful for us to know that we can do that. So that moment of stopping and turning around and saying, now I have the willingness to turn to some of that holding that might show up as pain, that we do that skillfully. And the first step is to acknowledge that in some of that holding that we experience is a hidden diamond. Something is calling us to turn to it. And even if that pain often shows up in moments where we don't want it, and even if the pain speaks to us in its cryptic words, we might not immediately be able to fully understand it. It might be worth to stop running away, to stop and turn to it. So the first step, and often that is the invitation when we come to a retreat, we stop, we take a breath, and we make space to be with us, to meet us. And one of the beautiful things on a Zoom retreat is that we do this in the midst of our lives. So what a wonderful practice to have those moments carved out, and then we re-engage with the world around us. So we learn to very gently approach that what was hidden away from it. And that means that first we bring the awareness that there might be some discomfort. And by turning to that discomfort, we acknowledge that we have often developed ways of avoidance turning to. And we can hold that kindly. But it might be useful to turn to what is calling us. There is a saying by Rumi, the cure for the pain is in the pain. The cure for the pain is in the pain. but gently holding. And so it could be if too early on we begin to turn away from that pain before we are approaching and seeing that diamond, we would miss out that possibility that lies in the pain. So there is a song from Leonard Cohen where there is a crack, the light comes in. And I guess most of us to some extent have experienced times in our life where things had to crack open. And the light will show us the things that want to attend to. So in this process of being able to meet what is, we need to be present. If we are not present, how can we meet what is? So in the yoga after the first Yoga Sutra, which says, and now comes the discipline of the yoga. It says, yoga is a practice to still your mind so that the observing nature of your mind gets established. So instead of getting lost in all the vrittis or the activities in our mind, we are engaging in a practice where the mind slowly can become more stable. It's a bit like if you would stand on a wobbly surface, it would be very difficult to use and look into the stars. You would constantly lose your focus. So you need something of an inner stability so that you can meet what wants to show up, what wants to reveal itself. So by establishing that capacity, by being present to body and breath, we begin to establish that observing part of our mind. And that observing part of our mind has a quality of warmth, of a loving presence, so that it can hoard what reveals itself from that place of seeing. And that is the first step where we connect with ourselves. So that in that process, we can begin to connect with others. So in that showing up, and I find, obviously, there might be things we don't like or things we are afraid of. So we do that very gentle, very skillful, and we need to be patient. And I think a Christian nun, I lived for 7 years in an interfaith community, established by an order of the Christian Anglican Church here in England. So I got a lot of interesting stories from their tradition and learned a lot from their tradition. And there was a story from one of the sisters from a different tradition, but she had been newly ordained and it was her first service where in those days, I think they offered you wine but also alternatives. And just when she was getting ready and she was dressed and there was this white cloth on the altar, she somehow stumbled and the wine was splashed over herself and about everything. And there was no time she could change it. And she describes that she stood there and says, here I am in all my mess. And it was like, yes, here I am. I still can do what I'm supposed to be doing, but I'm here in all my visible mess. Well, what a lovely invitation for those who were there with her in that moment. So I think that is the place from which we work, that welcoming. And the yoga practice itself, the word yoga is often obviously translated as that bringing us together, uniting those different selves in us that are pulling us here and there and finding something that is of a stability, that is more of that internal center of noticing it. But I thought it's interesting, the word yoga also, as all these words, holds the meaning of disentanglement. some words in English, I'm German, or they are like mousse au chocolat. Disentanglement. Lovely word. I think in the word itself, you feel that entanglement, and then you feel that disentanglement. So when we are engaging in that practice of yoga, we are engaging also in a practice of disentanglement. So it means you're stopping us from getting entangled from whatever stops us to live our lives more freely. In the my yoga teacher gives an example from, I guess, from the Upanishads, where he describes that the core, the essence of our being is like a tree, and on the tree is a branch. So the we and the branch is obviously connected with the tree and with its roots. And on this branch, two birds are sitting. And one bird is looking outside, away from the tree. Both of them are sitting on the branch. And the other bird is sitting and looking towards the tree. And what that means, that we have lost that connection with the bird that is willing to connect, to look to its root, to the tree. And we are too much engaged with that part of our mind, symbolized in that bird, that is looking outside, that is looking for answers outside of us, and that looks to find what it is looking for in this changing world in the outside. And as you see, both birds sit on this branch, and therefore it's beautiful. So they are both valid. But it seems one bird is a bit more weighted and the other is a bit forgotten. And therefore, that disentanglement is the invitation to turn to that inwardly, to find that inner connection again, to the essence or source of our being. When we understand yoga in that way, we might understand that going on a detox yoga retreat might not cut the cloth. And we might begin to realize touching your toes might not probably get you there. Fine if you can touch your toes. Fine if you can't touch your toes. Touching your toes or not touching your toes has nothing to do with how much you are able to connect back into the essence of your being. Yeah. Unfortunately, that idea is very much presented about the yoga because we want to show something, we want to see something. Yeah. So, in a way, we speak therefore of the outward-looking nature of our mind, the inward-looking nature of our mind, and that connecting with the source so that we have that stability from which we reconnect with the world around us. In this process, the yoga is defined in its eight limbs. Again, sometimes it was traditionally related to as the eight rungs of a ladder, but that could give us a hierarchical idea, where it's the limbs remind us the hand is connected with the arm, with the torso. So it connects us that all the aspects of the yoga, although we can single them out, they are connected. And I think, for example, today, somebody we did a movement of our arms, and somebody noticed in the chat room that the pelvis was moving. Yeah. So we did something in the shoulder level, and something was occurring in the pelvis. So on a very basic level, therefore, we can understand how things are connected. So one of the things of the so we have the five yamas that are ways how we relate again to ways and attitudes to the outer world. You will have been spoken about the five precepts coming on this retreat. So I think possibly referring to more our practice, there is an attitude, what we call ahimsa, non-violence, so ways of moving your body in that close relationship. And words that might sit there with us is when there is a physical pain in the body, it might shout you to stop. Normally, it's better when there's a pain to stop, step back a bit, and then approach it and work more skillfully around it. There's also the words, don't get it right. That comes from a Feldenkrais teacher. I love that. There, some of the styles in yoga, Pilates, dance, and these are beautiful systems, how they are presented, but they can become sometimes quite prescriptive. And there could be the point that you're trying to put your body into a position that is not appropriate for the condition your body is in or for what you are. A very extreme, I know a ballet dancer. She had already with 34 two hip operations, because the ways that they move their bodies, it looks very beautiful, but it's often quite out of the natural alignment of their bodies. And similar, we know that from gymnasts, how they later suffer excruciating back pains and stuff like that. So we know there are ways our body moves, and we might need really to be very attentive to the feedback, how the body reveals itself to us. It is in that attentiveness that we learn to listen to the voice of the silence and the quietness. So it's a training in that attentiveness, in that listening. So if we need some more freedom around those structures, or for some they provide good holding and some of us might not want to step out of those structures. But if we want to step out of them, and we did, for example, in the afternoon, we explored different ways of doing and approaching the same posture, then it might be helpful to consider what Moshe Feldenkrais, a movement teacher, said, the late Feldenkrais. Get the movement wrong. Dare to get it wrong. We are so limited nowadays. We are so frightened to get things wrong. And so he says, get it deliberately wrong, which then obviously is not getting it wrong, but invites creativity in. See what works. Receive the feedback of your body, what works. And as I said, if you look at the early development stages of animals, of babies, when they begin to move, there is a natural evolving of that movement. They don't need to be told, keep your belly in, drop your shoulders, lift your neck, lengthen your spine. So all these instructions are very invitational. They are really just inviting in an impulse to come into your body and noticing then, what does that feel like? So there is a kindness. And in my experience, there are systems of working in the yoga, in Pilates, and other systems that in my sense take that away. We hand over too much responsibility to the teacher, the system, and we lose that ability to trust ourselves. Yeah, so get it wrong. Yeah. And in such you get it right. And your creativity comes back. Yeah. And with creativity, joy comes back. We say, in fact, all the creation is an expression of the joy of the divinity of the universe. When we in joy, we become creative. Yeah. So be part of that joy and dare to get something wrong. Yeah. Place your hands slightly differently. Who is telling you that the hands should always exactly sit under the shoulders? Yeah. What would it be like to have them slightly wider, slightly more forwards, slightly more backwards? So much more to explore. Yeah. So you can see that that sense of exploration carries in it non-violence. So you're not pushing yourself into a preconceived shape. You don't make your body fit a shape. Yeah. Sometimes the shape is good. It gives us guidance. And at one point, it might become a constraint. Yeah. And then we need to get out of it. I think it's similar when a baby is in the womb of the mother. It needs that safety. It needs that constraint. But the baby has to come out. It has to come out. Because that constraint can die if it doesn't come out. It needs to come out. So there is some holding in it, some nourishment, and there might be a point when we need to open up, where we need to open up out of those constraints. Another aspect, again, all the yoga is always to be seen in its spiritual aspect, is the aspect of non-greed. And we can see that in relation to the world around us. And we can again see it in relation to the ways how we move. Is there a greed? Is there a goal in the yoga? Yeah. And my sense is no. Yoga is just asana, posture. It's just the joy of moving the body. The joy of moving the body. And that is a never-ending movement from the first day of our life to the last day of our lives. Yeah. So there doesn't need to be any greed around the posture to reach the end. Be playful with it. But I think that aspect, so there could be a grasping around it. There could be an attitude coming in instead of allowing that flow of life to flow through that posture, through that asana. We begin to want to impress others. So we become again more outbound. Because by impressing others, we might get positive feedback that might give us the sense of a fullness, of a sense of a confidence that we might lacking inside. And what a difference that is when we express ourselves, when we express ourselves from the depth of our being, also through our movement. But the quality where it's coming from is very different. One is rooted in a sense of emptiness, in a sense of lacking that we need to greet, and that can be ways of wanting to receive some approval, and therefore we need to impress others. And that will always bring some tension. Yeah. Whereas when the same movement is done as a way of expressing ourselves, it will not carry that slight tension in it. Yeah. And therefore let our yoga moves be a way of expressing the life that moves through us with that quality of ease and enjoyment. And that means also that we will, in this process of non-violence and not greedy, but being moving with what is, we have to accept limitations. Limitations of age, of capabilities. And in the outward world, we also have to see not everything we might want to do would be good for us. It could burden us, it could burden others. And the more we are connected with the quality of an inner fullness or contentment. That is nearly the antidote to that quality. Can we be content in the posture we are doing, in the way how we are doing it? I'm recently started reading and finished the book by Pope Francis, quite a small book, Let Us Dream. He picks up the issue of climate change, I think, also the church aspects, but I think he has, I quote him, and obviously it's in the context of the Christian wording, but I feel it sits very well with this idea of non-violence and non-greed. Sin is the rejection of the limits that love requires. Sin is the rejection of the limits that love requires. Love requires us to accept that at times we might be able to engage with something, and out of love, we are setting us limits. And we can see that very clearly in relation to climate change and the way how we are using this earth. We are rejecting the limits that love for this creation might require of us. And this earth has gone tired. This earth is struggling to replenish itself. This earth is tired to restore itself. Because we are taking more from it, and we need to look at that. No? So our love for this earth, for this creation, requires from us to accept some limits. And what Pope Francis says in his definition, by rejecting these limits, that come from love. Yeah. That is a sin. Yeah. And it's not only a sin against the earth, it's a sin against us because we are living on this earth. Yeah. So the word might not sit well with all of you, but I hope the spirit of that love requires us that we neither burden others nor burden ourselves. And that means that from that act, we might accept either limitations that are there, or we need actively engage in some limitations because they could burden us or others. So that is some of the five aspects in the yoga in relation to the outer world. But in the yoga, it always is also a mirroring for our inner world. From the next one, let me see. Then we have attitudes that we bring to ourselves. So we develop the attitude of contentment. We develop that awarenessing practice, that self-reflection about ourselves and the bigger self, that what in yoga we would call, what is that in me that is aware? Or it could be, what is that? That open questioning. So that awareness that, or that sits well with that issue of Svadhyaya study. And one word, again, often only used in the physical context, but referred to in the inward-bound mental context, is that we develop tapas, heat. So now we have practices in the yoga where you are supposed to sweat, where you move fast and you get hot. And that is on the physical level. And that can feel for very good. It can, the sweat can help you to really feel better afterwards. Your muscles got warmed up. So it can have an aspect on your physical side. But what tapas refers to is the spiritual side. Definitely. The other side is fine, but not everybody needs to do that side. You could also go into a sauna. And I remember for many years I was teaching in Russia when Gorbachev was president. I traveled over there to teach. And I was in Sochi. And Sochi, was where the Winter Olympics was, which is very strange because it is the hottest part of Russia. It is the most southern part of Russia. So the coldest part is 16 hours flight is Siberia. So I was sometimes teaching in Siberia. I was located in Sochi, and it was a 16-hour flight in those days, all over the through Russia from Sochi to Siberia. But they had saunas in the summer, and I thought that's odd. I only go in a sauna in the winter, but they had saunas in summer. And then they had this wonderful tradition, which was first a bit odd. From the birch trees, they had these young branches. And they were beating you with these branches in the hot sauna. And then they wrapped you. They had lots of honey, with honey, good for your skin. But you got really hot and your body felt really nice and warm. And then obviously you got out of the sauna, and when you're in Russia, you have to drink vodka. There is no way around it. And I had been practicing yoga for about 20 years, and I hadn't touched alcohol for many, many years. And there I was sitting, do I offend my guests or do I drink a bit of vodka? And they were so friendly. So every day I had to drink a bit of vodka. And I think it made my teaching a bit lighter. Because in those days, I had a bit of a sternness with me, a bit of a rigidity. Life had not yet cracked me fully open. So it was quite helpful to have a bit of vodka in the evening, and I learned a few words of Russian, and mostly I think it was like "Do svidaniya," and we were clapping our glasses. But it helped me definitely to ease off and feel very comfortable with these wonderful, generous people. And it created a bit of an inner heat. But all of these things are not referred to, they can be beneficial. But what we speak about tapas as creating some inner heat, some inner fire response. And again, it's wonderful. It has two meanings. Tapas means that you develop a burning desire to come to liberation. So there is skillful desires, a desire to continue the practice, a burning desire to continue your path. And it also, and it has the meaning, it also means burning your desires. A burning desire to come to the end of your desires, and a burning to come to liberation. So beautiful. Both held in this one word, tapas. And so therefore, again, you don't need to be beaten up in a Russian sauna. You don't need to drink vodka to get hot inside. Hot chocolate can do it. But the key point is in all yogas, always consider yoga as a spiritual practice. So all these words are possibly put a bit too much into the physical aspects of the practice and pulled, unfortunately, a bit too far away from that aspect. And same when we look at asana, which would be the posture practice. there is always this twisting of words, and it can help you sometimes to really understand the meaning of that word more. So asana is often what is referred to when we do and engage in the postures, and there's now lots of different ways to engage in the postures. My training was in classical yoga, very slow postures, very long holding of postures, and we might do tomorrow some of that, because we have moved through the body and hopefully that we will be able to go more into that type of practice. But it also refers to seat. Asana in the Patanjali Sutras is just translated as seat for your meditation. Then in the wider aspect of life, it is, what kind of seat are you taking in this world? What's the way you are relating to this world around you? What's your seat in this world? What are your ways of moving in this world? Are you moving in this world? Seat. Yeah, sorry, not S-E-E-D, seat. So it's your meditation seat. What's your, thank you, my English German. It should be seat, not seat. Thank you. It's great to have that chat. Thank you for your asking. So, but it also obviously asana means movement. So we are moving into this world, and we are moving into this world with our body. So how do we facilitate this body movement? What kind of actions come through us, out of us? Actions of kindness, actions of hate, of jealousy. So that is again the vaster aspect. What we do with our bodies is moving them into this world. And by turning into our bodies, we can notice qualities that are helpful in our movements. So we will possibly notice that every part in our body is cooperating with the other parts in our body. Yeah? They have to work together. Where we have pain, where there's discomfort, they have lost that ability, because there might be muscular imbalances, there might have been an injury. But generally, all the systems in the body want to work so well together for the well-being of us. Yeah. So they are cooperating with each other, and there is no hierarchy. Yeah, the heart is equally, the pumping of the heart is equally important as the movement of the lungs, the breathing, as the pulsation in our internal organs. They all have their own unique rhythm, but they are cooperating with each other as good as they can. And they have mutual respect for each other. There's not one organ that says, I'm more important. Yeah. It wouldn't work. Yeah. So in this way, again, a beautiful way, when we really feel that beauty of the body moving, the inner beauty in the body, that we feel that this flows out and we see the same around us, how in nature things are cooperating, respecting each other. It's wonderful to see the birds in the sky, these big swarms, and how they never bang into each other. No, they all, and they oh, it's so beautiful. And they slush over here and they slush over there and they change places, but they never bang into each other. They are cooperating with each other. They are coordinating their actions, and there is a respect to each other. Yeah. And the same quality is in us, and we want to feel that. And therefore, when a movement gets jerky, when we force it, we push it, we might just bring in a bit of a discomfort into the body. And we might disturb that beautiful functioning. So be so attentive. Yeah. And with that quality, we move into the world so that we cooperate with it, that we live in it with respect, that we give what is there in front of us respect. Respect means giving something weight, giving something importance. We give us importance, the breath, and we give that around us importance. And the breath again. Oh. So before I go to the breath, normally called pranayama, I came about a wonderful quote again by Rumi. Rumi has that song quality, I think. And depending on where I am, sometimes I need a lot of Rumi and a lot of singing. And sometimes I need much more of a stillness and stability. But in the moment, it seems I'm a bit of singing going to Rumi. And Rumi says something beautiful in relation, I think, to asana, to that differentiation about impressing others or expressing life that is in you through you. He says, the bird sings because it has a song. The bird sings because it has a song. Such a natural quality. And he says, I want to sing like the birds sing, not worrying about who hears or what they think. I want to sing like the birds sing, not worrying about who hears or what they think. What a wonderful way of, and what has happened to parts of our yoga practice, where so much seems to be bound up in to be seen and to be judged and to be measured, and to lose that wonderful ability to express ourselves. Yeah. And pranayama, again, is a reminder that when we are breathing, we are connecting. There's lots of things we could say about pranayama, but again, it has, I'm noticing I'm coming to the end, it has, again, two translations. And one is the known one, and it speaks more about technique, control, restrain. That's often the one that is used. And I always felt uncomfortable with that in the ways by how I learned my pranayama with my teacher. That seemed to have so much more of an attentiveness and a fluidity to it. But there is also an expression where instead of saying pranayama, it says prana ayama. And that means then, when you put these two words a bit apart, it refers to freedom around your breathing, breath expansion, liberation in your breathing. And that sounds a bit different. And what it refers to as a pointer is, what we did this morning in our pranayama, is that there is a space around us and that is full. And when I'm breathing in, that prana, not only the breath, but an energy comes in me and I am full too. So the breath moves between the fullness in me and the fullness around me. It moves between the silence in me and the silence around me. And therefore, it enables me to feel in this connection. And it helps us to develop that sense in that inner feeling of a contentment, so that then we slowly lose that sense of something is lacking. We feel something that was disconnected can connect again. We can feel full again. And that is a fullness that cannot be taken away from us, because that is an experience that we have and that nobody can take from us. There would be so much more to say, but I think that is the limit. I know for myself, there is limits to what I can say. But I also know that some of the things will be with you and others you will have dropped off. And that's true. I often only work on one sentence. My teacher speaks for 3.5 hours. And then sometimes my husband or friends ask, so what was this talk about? And I summarize it in 3 sentences because I'm just flowing with it and I'm hearing it. But at the end, I can just summarize it in 3 sentences. So I'm trusting that from what I've said, it's about the spirit. It is not important that all the time your awareness will have moved in and out. It's part of at this time of the day and generally. But I thought I want some of the things we anyway explore in our practices, but I thought something that might bring us to the end. So the practice of yoga is to get into that sense of where we are held in the universe itself and where we might experience applies Rumi. You are not a drop in the ocean. You are the entire ocean in a drop. You are not a drop in the ocean. You are the entire ocean in a drop. And in that way, I think that's a good place to end, that sense of space in us and around us, and that sense how the breath connects us to that ability to experience that in moments of our practice. So I suggest we sit a moment in silence, a minute in silence.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.